You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, it's the weekly World News Roundup from Australia to Haiti and beyond. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, we've been hearing each week on Central Time a new installment of the WPR Reports podcast, Mapped Out, telling the story of how Republicans in the state drew legislative maps that helped to cement their majority. Spoiler alert, the state is getting new maps, and Republicans in the legislature released their proposed maps this week. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How big a deal are these legislative district maps to you? Is it a story you've been following, or have you just started to follow it? Maybe thanks to the Mapped Out podcast. How should we draw these lines? Do you worry that they give one party or the other, depending on who draws it, a partisan advantage? And what questions do you have about how all this works and how it's going this time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Sean Johnson is WPR's Capital Bureau Chief. He's also co-host of the WPR Reports podcast, Mapped Out, with Bridget Bowden. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob.
Well, you've been so immersed in 10 years ago, Sean. Now here's new news this week on these new maps. What are we seeing in these maps from Republican lawmakers?
A little bit of history repeating itself in that 10 years ago, they drew a very strongly Republican map. And what they've presented this year is a very strong Republican map. You know, there was some talk, at least among some Republicans, that given that this is going to be decided by a court, most likely in the very end, that you might see kind of a different map presented by the Republican legislature. But I would say basically you have a very strong Republican map here, you know, Republican gerrymander in the proposal that they've released, just as they had a decade ago.
We have another set of maps out earlier this month from the governor's People's Maps Commission. What kind of things did they come up with?
The People's Maps Commission, it was established by a Democratic governor, and so I think there was some thought that it might go the other direction, you know, that you might have Democratic maps. And I mean, those maps are definitely better for Democrats than the existing map or the one that Republicans have proposed. But you do see a bit of a Republican lean in the state legislative races for the draft maps that have been released so far by this People's Maps Commission. And that's not because they set out to draw it, you know, leaning toward Republicans. It's because Wisconsin's political geography, where Democrats live more, you know, more in the dense cities of the state and Republicans are more spread out, does give Republicans an advantage when it comes to map drawing. So they ended up with, I think one of their scenarios was like a 53% Republican lean in the state assembly map. Not as strongly Republican as we have by now, right now by a long shot, but still, you kind of see the situation we are in here in Wisconsin.
Now, an important distinction, this map drawn by lawmakers is part of the regular map making process. This People's Commission map, it's just sort of an outside thing, right? It's not part of the usual way these things are done.
At the end of the day, it's going to be a suggestion. I would expect that there will be a Democratic lawmaker when the legislature debates redistricting who will produce it as an amendment and say, hey, let's vote on this. Let's pass this on instead. Let's give this an up or down vote. But the legislature is under no obligation to do it. You can also see the People's Maps Commission maps becoming relevant if and when this goes to court, where they could present this to a court and say, look, we did this out in the open. Here's our homework. Here's how we arrived at this. You, court, should choose this plan over what passed the legislature.
Talking to Sean Johnson, WPR Capital Bureau Chief, about redistricting maps. Republican lawmakers released their initial maps just this week. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Sean, you mentioned this could end up in court, and one of the main ways that could happen, as has happened so many times in Wisconsin before, the governor could veto whatever the Republicans end up putting on his desk. Does that seem likely at this point?
He's sending pretty strong hints, the governor is, that he's going to veto this map if this is what passes the legislature. Essentially put out a statement yesterday or when the maps came out saying, hey, you're going to have to do better than this if you want me to sign this. He referred to them as gerrymandering 2.0. And he's previously said that if it's gerrymandering 2.0, I'm going to veto it. So he's not leaving a lot of mystery there. The governor is not, when it comes to how he's going to receive these maps.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in Shawano. Steve, hi.
Yeah, hi there. I hope you can hear me. I'm on a cell phone. I probably might lose you here in the woods. I have a real problem with the whole idea of gerrymandering, because I really think it's, you know, citizens unite in gerrymandering. I think, you know, the two greatest threats to our democracy. And the problem I have with gerrymandering is it's based on politics, not population. And I think the simple solution is that everybody knows what county they live in. I live in Shawano County. People live in O'Connell County. People live in Oneida County, Brown, et cetera. But ask them what assembly they, district they are. Ask them who's their senator, their state senator representative is. And their eyes will glaze over because they don't know. And if you look at the maps of the various assemblies and House of Representatives district lines, they're just incredibly oddball, obtuse forms that just are just nonsensical. I mean, there's some districts where they'll have portions of like six or eight counties in one district. And then, but then the other representative district is totally diverse from that. So anyhow, what I think the simple solution is, you take the census numbers and you plug it all into a data in a computer, and then you let the computer pick the districts. And it's based on population, and you use county lines as a primary means of differentiation. And if you have to break up a county like Milwaukee or Dane or Brown or something like that because of population, then you can get down to the township. Or if you're in a municipality, you can use precincts. But you use existing, you know, district line, or, you know, lines of demarcation. You know,
I gotcha. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. And Sean, as I've learned from the podcast Mapped Out, those lines of demarcation are supposed to be at least one of the criteria used already, right?
Yeah, it is one of those criteria that is extremely subjective, though, because you're going to have to break someone up. And so if you prioritize that criteria, it might come at the expense of something else. You know, Republicans actually are pointing to their map and saying we would actually break up fewer communities than, you know, than the People's Maps Commission map. And yet they have a much stronger Republican lean to their map. So they're trade-offs. There are trade-offs every time. And just prioritizing like county lines and local government lines above all else can have unintended consequences.
Thanks for that call. Sean, I know at various points mathematicians have gotten involved trying to make more neutral maps. I mean, is there such a thing as like an objective map that, you know, nobody has to put their finger on a scale at any point?
The People's Maps Commission is working with a nationally renowned mathematician actually to draw their maps. And part of the way that they drew it is they said, we want to have one of the factors we look at be partisan fairness. We want to have this map when all these other criteria are satisfied, you know, equal population, don't break up communities. We also want to favor a map that more resembles Wisconsin in statewide elections. That is, we are a 50-50 state. We should have a legislature that kind of bends that direction anyway. And you see what happens when you kind of plug all that in. You put one of the brightest math minds in the country in charge of the process, or at least give her a seat at the table. I'm not sure it's the kind of thing where you can just plug it into a computer and spit out the right answer that's going to please everyone.
And briefly, Sean, as we wrap up, what is next on the mapping timeline?
There's a public hearing in the legislature next week on the Republican map. It's on Thursday. I don't know yet when the legislature is going to pass their plan. I would presume a governor veto pretty soon after that. And then, you know, whenever the legislature and the governor are done with what they're going to do, the state Supreme Court gets the first shot at this.
Sean, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief, co-host of the WPR Reports podcast, Mapped Out. More coming on Wisconsin redistricting, including some of the legal angle that Sean was just touching on. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the way maps are drawn, the way they were drawn last time? What would you want to see, if anything, work differently about all of this? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about redistricting. Currently in process here in Wisconsin, Republican lawmakers released their proposed maps earlier this week. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Robert Yablon is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School. His research interests include political and election law, constitutional law, federal courts, and statutory interpretation. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here. Happy Friday.
Well, let's pick up where I left off with Sean there. A likely veto from Governor Evers on this Republican-drawn map. State courts, he said, would get the first crack at it. Why is that? I know in the past, a lot of our maps have ended up being decided by federal courts.
Well, I think the answer mainly is because they are indicating this time around the state Supreme Court that they are willing to do the work. And there is some precedent from the U.S. Supreme Court suggesting that when state actors, whether we're talking about state political actors or state courts, are in fact moving forward to try to draw district lines, then federal courts should typically take a back seat. And so right now there are pending lawsuits in the state Supreme Court and in federal court. The federal lawsuit is kind of on pause at the moment, and it's that state Supreme Court lawsuit that is taking center stage right now.
People have talked about courts ending up drawing new maps, which has happened in Wisconsin in the past. One possible outcome, though, Rob, check me if I'm wrong, the lawmakers could pass their map, the governor could veto it, it ends up in the state Supreme Court. The state Supreme Court could theoretically say, yeah, Republican map, we love it, sign off on it exactly as drawn. That's one possible outcome, right?
The map that the legislature is going to pass here in the coming weeks is presumably one that they'll present to the state Supreme Court, and one option for the state Supreme Court would be to just sign off on that map, yes.
What are some of the things that end up being argued about in a court, state or federal, when it comes to these maps, when they're disputed by the two different branches, two other branches of government?
Right. Well, you know, the obligation that a court has is to ensure that the maps comply with a number of federal and state legal principles. And so there's going to be a lot of debate between, you know, we're going to get a lot of maps submitted, maps from the legislature, the People's Maps Commission maps, and a number of other litigants will probably come in with their own maps. And there's going to be discussion about which of those maps do the best job complying with the requirements that the law sets out, and that also maybe do the best job on some discretionary criteria that you might hope to have in a map, such as partisan fairness. So by law, federal law, you have to have districts that are relatively equally populated. You have to comply with the Voting Rights Act, which is meant to ensure electoral opportunities for large and politically cohesive minority groups. Then as a matter of state law, you need to ensure that you're drawing districts that are contiguous and as compact as is practical, and you want to try to minimize the number of times that you're splitting political subdivision boundaries. So all of that gets thrown into the mix, and the court needs to try to figure out which submitted map fits the bill best, or whether it needs to do some of its own mapping.
A key point in all of that, though, is the argument over gerrymandering is the partisan slant that a map can give. There's not really any law against that, though, right, at the state or federal level. That, even going up to the U.S. Supreme Court, hasn't led to maps being thrown out, at least by federal courts, over partisan gerrymandering. Do I have that right?
That's right. Federal courts have said that this is just not something they're going to regulate. And so that means that state lawmakers have pretty free rein to seek to tilt the playing field in one partisan direction or another. There are some states in which the state Supreme Courts or lower state courts have said as a matter of state law that there are some limits on partisan gerrymandering. That isn't something that has really been litigated directly in Wisconsin to this point. So there is right now no law on the books that would constrain attempts at partisan gerrymandering here in Wisconsin.
Right. In my memory, I think Pennsylvania's, I think state Supreme Court had said, hey, you got to redraw the map. And I think a North Carolina map, if I'm not mistaken. So we have seen in state courts, as you say, back to the drawing board on maps over the issue of partisan gerrymandering.
Yes. I mean, those are the two big recent examples, Pennsylvania and North Carolina.
Talking to Rob Yablon from the UW Law School about Wisconsin's map drawing system here for our political boundaries. Big story this week, Republicans in the legislature out with their initial map proposal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to our callers. Barb is with us. in Madison. Barb, hi.
Oh, hi. I'm your first caller, I guess. Thanks. I have been trying to follow the gerrymandering movies and workshops and learning about what gerrymandering actually means to the average citizen of Wisconsin, and it's very complicated and a lot more it affects a lot more of us than we realize. And I think we should fight tooth and nail for a nonpartisan district. It doesn't do us any good to have pro-Democratic or pro-Republican districts, because then our legislators don't have to listen to our constituent voices. And I've been very irritated with Ron Johnson at the federal level and Robin Voss at the state level, who doesn't care about what I care about, and he doesn't respond with any real interest in the way that I think or care or my opinion. So,
Barb, got it, Barb. Thanks a lot for the call. Barb gave us a lot to work with there. Rob, first of all, the idea, and I've heard this argument advanced, that a gerrymandered legislature in particular means that lawmakers don't have to represent part of their constituency. They don't have to look over their shoulders because they know that their party is very, very likely to win their district.
Yeah, there's no question that gerrymandering affects the way that the state is governed. It means that there are fewer districts that are competitive, more safe seats. That can mean that there is less electoral accountability. It can mean that the representatives who are voted into office are the ones who represent the extremes of one party or the other. So less room for centrism and negotiation. And, and that might mean that there's just less room for compromise in the legislature. And all of that can affect, the way that the citizens of the state experience politics. And I think you heard a little bit of that with the caller. I mean, gerrymandering certainly contributes to cynicism and disaffection and maybe even disengagement among some members of the electorate.
And Barb also mentioned having a neutral party or some kind of outside party apart from, the legislature and the governor draw these maps. There are states where it works like that, I think, including like Iowa and Colorado. What other models are there for drawing these lines?
Yeah, there are a growing number of states that have tried to take redistricting at least partly out of the hands of the legislature. The Iowa model is one that's often held out there as a model where you have nonpartisan staff members of the legislature who draw lines without any reference to political criteria, and they've had that in place for several decades in Iowa. There are newer models in states, you mentioned Colorado, but also California, Arizona. They have tried to create nonpartisan commissions. You can use bipartisan commissions as well. And again, if you have criteria that try to disassociate the map making from politics and you give those nonpartisan or bipartisan commissioners other criteria to focus on, then maybe that also can result in some fairer maps.
Thanks for the call, Barb, at 800-642-1234. Rob, one interesting thing that came out of the People's Maps Commission was some of their map recommendations still had a Republican lean, not as strong as the one drawn by Republican lawmakers. And people have been pointing to the idea that Democrats tend to cluster in larger cities, and that makes it harder to draw pro-Democratic maps in a natural way. Is that something you're seeing? Is that part of the story here?
I think that that is part of the story that you're seeing from the People's Maps Commission maps. The political geography of Wisconsin probably does lean modestly in the Republicans' direction because of the packing of Democratic voters in Madison and Milwaukee. That political geography certainly doesn't require anything like the gerrymandered map that we've had for the past decade, which takes that sort of modest Republican leaning and really exaggerates it to a much greater extent. So it is possible, and I think the People's Maps Commission has shown this, it's possible to get much closer to proportional representation while still having districts that are quite compact and do a pretty good job respecting political subdivision boundary lines.
Let's bring on another caller now. Chris is with us in Appleton. Chris, hi.
Hi, thank you. My question is, when was the last time Wisconsin had a more proportional legislature, 50-50 Republican-Democrat?
Thanks for the call, Chris. And I know after 2010, before the new maps were drawn, the Senate was really close because briefly a couple Senate recalls were enough to flip it from Republican to Democratic control. So that's we've had close divides in the legislature in years past, Rob.
That's right. I mean, in the 1980s, the 1990s, and the 2000s, all of those maps were drawn by courts, and they were relatively neutral maps. They were maps in which if it was a good year for Democrats, the Democrats had a real chance of controlling the legislature, and vice versa for Republicans. So it was that the map that was adopted in 2011 replaced what had been a more neutral court-drawn map.
Thanks a lot for that call. Rob, one big question. People point toward a conservative majority on Wisconsin's Supreme Court. And Democrats might worry that that means they're more likely to go along with a Republican map. Is it that simple?
I don't think it is that simple. You know, I think that there are we do think of our Supreme Court as one that is a 4-3 conservative majority, but those four justices are not uniform in their views. Although they often side with the Republicans in the legislature on important issues, they don't always. And so, you know, they will do the legal analysis here, and it is possible that they may find that they are going the legislature's way, but they're going to feel some pressure, I think, from both the law and the citizens of this state, many of whom I think want a more neutral map, to do something maybe a little bit different from what the legislature is asking for.
Rob, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Good to be with you.
Rob Yablon is an associate professor in the UW Law School. We talked to him about some of the legal questions behind Wisconsin's redistricting process after we saw maps released this week by Republican lawmakers. Coming up Monday on Central Time, there's a new space race as countries around the world prepare for the orbital businesses of the future and for conflict in Earth's orbit. And we'll learn why the world of modern surfing owes a debt to Wisconsin. That and more. It's all coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll dig deep into the science of fungus with mushrooms and more. A UW fungus expert shares highlights from this year's Wisconsin Science Festival with a focus on the strange species of the fungal world. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll get a winter's worth of ideas on cooking with potatoes. First, it's time to put the fun in fungi. Mushrooms and other fungi are one of the themes of this year's Wisconsin Science Festival, taking place at locations all over the state this weekend. Fungi are an enormous and extremely diverse group of organisms. Scientists believe only about 5% of all the species of fungi in the world have been discovered and identified, about 74,000 of an estimated 1.5 million. We're going to talk about just a few of those 74,000 known species today, and we'll zero in on some fungi that live here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Bring us all of your mycology and other fungus-related questions. Do you need help identifying a mushroom growing maybe in your backyard? Do you forage for mushrooms? Are they a favorite fungus of yours? Call in with your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Ann Pringle is a professor of botany and bacteriology at UW-Madison and former president of the Mycological Society of America. Ann, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's nice to be here.
Well, fungus. Now, it's not a plant. It's not an animal. It's still a form of life. How do we fit it into our sort of framework, our category of stuff that's alive?
That's a great question. So a long, long time ago, when people were looking at mushrooms, people would come to the conclusion that because they didn't move, somehow they were plants. Plants don't move. These things don't move. Fungi must be plants. So I'm in the Department of Botany because that's the historical association people have of fungi. But fungi are really distantly related to plants. And it turns out we know from DNA evidence that fungi are much more closely related to animals than they are to plants. And that's one of the reasons if unfortunately, a person develops a fungal infection that's really hard to treat because mostly the drugs that would kill a fungus would do harm to a person as well. So that's just kind of another clue that actually fungi are more closely related to us than they are to plants. But they're their own kingdom. They're their own entity, their own group of organisms, actually really distinct from both plants and animals.
Now, that disease thing, I've got a browser open here, and I type the word fungal. Here are the autocompletes: fungal acne, fungal infection, fungal rash, fungal pneumonia, fungal ear infection. And those are real things. And we could talk about to fungus causing disease and other problems. But you think that the fungus world gets a bad rap. They do a lot of good stuff for us and for nature, right?
Yeah, they do. One role that fungi play in nature is as extensions of plant root systems. So no plant in nature grows alone. All plants grow in association with fungi, and some of the really critical fungi that plants grow with are what we call mycorrhizal fungi. That's a complex word, but myco just means fungus, and rhiza means root. So all that word means is that plants have fungus roots, and these fungus roots, these fungi, act as extensions of the root system. They find resources that plants can't otherwise get at and bring those resources to the plant in exchange for carbon. So that's one role. Another role is as decomposers. It's fall, the leaves are falling. Think of what would happen if all of those leaves stayed just as they are. We'd soon have quite a few leaves to deal with, and it would be a burden, but we don't have to worry about it because we put them in huge compost heaps, or the city does it for us, and they decompose and they turn into mulch, which we then use again on our garden. So those are two really important roles that fungi play as plant symbionts and also as decomposers.
Talking to Ann Pringle, professor of botany and bacteriology at UW-Madison, looking at the world of fungus. It is a star player in the Wisconsin Science Festival going on this weekend around the state. You can join in with your questions about fungus at 800-642-1234. Your favorite ones, if you, say, go out and collect mushrooms, if you use fungus in your line of work, which if you make bread or beer, you do. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. And let's meet some fungi now. Mushrooms, the most visible. If you're walking and you see fungus, it's probably a mushroom. Can you talk about the diversity, the incredible number of mushrooms out there?
Yeah, mushrooms are really lovely, aren't they? They're the above-ground bit of a much larger body that you can't see that's growing within a substrate. So the body is hidden in soil or hidden inside wood. And when the body reproduces, it sends up a mushroom. So that's what a mushroom is. And the mushroom has spores inside it, and the spores disperse away from the mushroom, and then those spores germinate and form new fungi. That's how it works. But fungi are, if you Google around and just look at images, if you Google beautiful fungi, you'll see mushrooms that are blue, they're yellow, they have spots, they have really interesting sort of network-shaped landing pads for insects. There's just an enormous diversity of form and of color. It's definitely way more than just a little brown mushroom that you find at the grocery store.
Now, speaking of things that are visible and related to fungi, you are doing stuff at the Wisconsin Science Festival. Do I have this right, a display out in Madison?
Yeah, right. So people should come on down to State Street. State Street is a happening place. We've got tons of booths. There are all kinds of vendors. Next to me on one side, there's a soul food vendor. On the other side, there's a jewelry vendor. And then sandwiched between the two of those, we have two booths on fungi. At one booth, you can solve the mystery of how the mushroom got its spots. Probably one of the more famous mushrooms in the world is the Super Mario Brothers mushroom, you know, the red one with white dots all over it. And if you've ever wondered why does it have those dots, if you come down to State Street, you can find out. And then our other booth is going to be showcasing a lot of different uses of fungi in our world. For example, you can use fungi and lichens to dye wool. It's your local dye palette, as my colleague says. Really beautiful purples and greens and yellows and oranges. And we have an example scarf and an example hat knit by a friend of mine that's knit out of yarn that's dyed with lichens and with mushrooms.
All right. And now I mentioned bread and beer. I guess we could throw pizza into the mix too. Anything made with yeast. Yeast, do I have this right, is a kind of fungus?
Exactly. A yeast is a single-celled fungus. And there have been multiple independent evolutions of this single-celled form. So the famous yeast that we cook with is a Saccharomyces. That's the genus of it, but there are all kinds of different yeasts in nature. Some of my favorite yeasts actually live inside the pitchers of carnivorous pitcher plants, which is an unexpected place to find a yeast if you've never thought about it that way before. But those carnivorous pitcher plants that you see around you in Wisconsin and in boggy places, they have little pools of water inside them, and yeast grow inside there as well.
Now, you mentioned a favorite yeast. You study a lot of different kinds of fungus, and it's unfair to ask you to pick a favorite. Do you have a favorite?
Yeah, actually, I do. And it's not actually one I study, but it's a sentimental favorite. There's a fungus, and it doesn't grow around us too much here in Wisconsin. It grows further south. But it's the name of it is Lactarius indigo. And as the name might suggest, it has a very intense indigo blue color. And my favorite thing about it is that if you cook it with scrambled eggs, then you can have green eggs and ham with some mushrooms in it too.
Okay.
It turns your eggs green.
I was surprised at the sentimental favorite fungus, but I get it now. The Dr. Seuss connection. That's awesome.
It's pretty great.
Now you have your eye on another fungus, a mushroom that we see here in Wisconsin. Maybe we're not supposed to. Golden oyster mushrooms. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, so that's a developing story and potentially a quite serious one. So lots of people like to grow mushrooms, right? It's a pretty fun thing to do. You can get like a shiitake log, and then you can have your own fresh shiitakes. Golden oysters are a species of oyster mushroom. They're not native to Wisconsin. They're not native to North America. They live in Russia and China and Japan, but they've started to be grown in the United States, these golden oysters, and they've escaped in the state of Wisconsin and in other states in the Midwest and on the East Coast, they've escaped cultivation. So now if you, for example, walk in Hoyt Park in Madison, you see golden oysters everywhere. And that's a real worry. When you see something in such profusion and abundance, you worry about whether it's displacing native species or what it might be doing to local carbon cycles. This is a fungus that was bred to eat quickly, to eat a lot, and to reproduce a lot. So those characteristics of a life cycle are a worry in terms of how it might take over local habitat. So that's a story that's happening right now. I can't tell you a whole lot about it. There was a beautiful master's thesis done by a woman named Andy Bruce at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse, and that's about as much as we know about it right now. And the thesis establishes that it's escaped cultivation and is spreading. But for the moment, I would say to people, if you're growing mushrooms, maybe consider growing something else. Don't grow golden oysters. Till we have a handle on what's going on there, maybe it's a good idea to not grow them.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Gary is with us in Brookfield. Gary, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Gary?
Well, we've been all of a sudden finding we're having these white puffball mushrooms in our backyard, and one grew the size of a soccer ball, and the other ones were like a large softball, and we found out you can eat them, and so we made them in slices and dipped them in egg and then breadcrumbs and fried them in butter, and they were absolutely delicious.
Interesting. And Gary, you said they just popped up. You hadn't had them, and then they were there all of a sudden?
Yeah. Well, one day the neighbor's kids saw them in the back because we live on the edge of a wetland area, and underneath the trees, they just popped up all of a sudden in the last couple of days. And the next door neighbor kids use them as balls, and they have a little rubbery outside of them, but you peel the outside off and then slice them in the bread or like steaks, mushroom steaks.
Gary, thank you so much. It sounds delicious, Anne, but it also makes me think like the spread habits of mushrooms. How do they suddenly show up in a new place where you haven't seen them before?
Yeah. First of all, it has been an amazing year for puffballs. Those ones that that Gary is seeing, those are Calvatia gigantea. But I've been seeing lots of other kinds of puffballs too. And if you want a recipe, the most fun recipe I've ever heard for those, first of all, to all your callers, make sure that you really understand the species that you're looking at before you cook with it. Of course, be very cautious. However, giant puffballs are amazing to eat. And if you're sure you've got a giant puffball, slice it in half and you can make a true cheese pizza because you use the slice of the puffball as the pizza dough, if that makes sense. So you can have a true like mushroom cheese pizza by having the mushroom as the base and sprinkled cheese all over it.
That is awesome. Thanks for sharing that story with us. We're talking to Ann Pringle, professor of botany and bacteriology at UW-Madison, former president of the Mycological Society of America. She's talking to us about fungi, a featured performer at the Wisconsin Science Festival going on in locations around the state this weekend. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a forager in the wild or in your own yard, as we just heard? What's the coolest mushroom you've ever found in Wisconsin or beyond? Do you have questions about the world of fungus, not just mushrooms? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with UW-Madison botany and bacteriology professor Ann Pringle. She's telling us all about fungi in Wisconsin and beyond as the Wisconsin Science Festival this weekend celebrates, among other things, the world of the fungus. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have a question about fungus, big or small. We got a comment from John in Menasha, who couldn't stay on the line, wanted to know why fungus grows psilocybin, that mind-altering substance in some mushrooms. John wants to know, what is in it for the fungus?
That is a really good question and a profound one. And the bottom line is that for a lot of these, I work with a mushroom that's invasive out on the West Coast, the death cap. It's deadly poisonous. It's Amanita phalloides. And with a lot of these mushrooms that make these crazy compounds, we don't really have a good answer as to the ecology of it. Even when the compounds are really useful, so psilocybin, I think a lot of your listeners will have heard about, but in the death cap, there are substances that are used by molecular biologists and cell biologists to stop cell growth. It's a tool in the lab. You buy it from companies. Companies sometimes ask me, where can I harvest these mushrooms so that we can extract the compounds out of it? So we know a lot about what it does in the laboratory context, and we know about a lot about what these compounds do, for example, to humans or to other model organisms, but the ecology of it, why do they make them in nature? Those questions are hardly studied. It's a really good question. I don't have a great answer.
Thanks a lot for the question. Go into some research yourself, John. I'm interested in the answer. Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Dave is with us in Madison. Dave, hi.
Hi. Hey, I've got two comments. One, the use of mushrooms in medicine is growing a lot in veterinary medicine. And then the second thing I wanted to mention was just a fun joke.
Okay.
Why did the mushroom buy everybody at the bar a drink?
I don't know, Dave. Why did the mushroom buy everybody at the bar a drink?
Because he's a fun guy.
Dave, thank you for the mushroom joke. And I imagine you've got some mushroom jokes, but let's tackle the first part of Dave's comment there. The use of fungus as medicine, including Dave said, veterinary medicine.
Yeah, it's fungi make all these incredible compounds. So I don't think it should be a surprise to anyone that if those compounds can be isolated, if they can be produced at a scale that makes them available to, you know, available, because you can't just rely on finding enough mushrooms in nature, for example, to extract the compound that you're interested in. You have to be able to grow the mushroom or somehow organically, you know, from an organic chemist perspective, manufacture the compound. But with those things in place, it doesn't come as a surprise to me that these compounds can do things to human bodies that are sometimes harmful, but sometimes really useful. In fact, the most common drug that I know of that was isolated from a fungus are statin drugs. So a lot of your listeners will be on certain kinds of statins, and statins were originally isolated out of yeast. There are lots of compounds that are potent within fungi.
Thanks a lot for that call. And the joke, Dave, we are talking to UW-Madison fungus expert Ann Pringle. back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Brian is on the line in Appleton. Brian, hi.
Hello. Yes. So we started, my wife and I started mushroom hunting a couple of years ago. She picked up a great book. I think it's Mushrooms in the Upper Midwest. And we've also taught our young children how to identify mushrooms and everything and pick them. And it's a fun, you know, thing for us to do. But I also want to make a comment about the golden oysters. So I didn't realize that those are actually not native. And this year, and we go to a variety of places across Wisconsin. And this year we saw an incredible amount of golden oysters everywhere, especially in the Dane County area. And we picked, I'm not kidding, somewhere around 30 to 35 pounds of those. And we would see logs just covered in whole areas of where logs are just covered in like several different spots. And they look really beautiful because they're kind of setting that golden color against like the green and the brown of the forest around. But I had no idea they're invasive species.
Interesting, Brian. Thanks for that report. And I guess there's no worry about over-harvesting those, Ann, but I wonder, since you said, you know, we're only seeing part of the mushroom, it's over the fungus substrate there, or in the substrate, does picking and harvesting an invasive mushroom really slow down its spread much?
I don't have an answer to that, but it sure can't hurt. if you're picking, you know, if you're picking golden oysters, the one thing I would say is that put them in a paper bag. Don't put them in a mesh bag. Traditionally, for example, often morel hunters will put their morels in a mesh bag, trying to encourage the growth of morels by letting the spores fall out as they carry the mushrooms out of the forest. And with a golden oyster, I would say we don't want to do that. We want to put the mushrooms into a paper bag and get them home. And don't put them in your compost pile. If you have leftovers, throw them away. Dispose of them in the same way. Think about it as garlic mustard, right? If you had garlic, extra garlic mustard around, you wouldn't necessarily compost that, or at least I don't. Yeah. Yeah, I am hoping that by getting the word out, people will start to notice these golden oysters and start to hear about it, because this dynamic that your caller's describing in Dane County, that's what I'm hearing about a lot lately.
Thanks a lot for that call. And you mentioned the need to cultivate or farm some kinds of mushrooms if you want to extract, say, a medicinal a part of it at a large scale. Is it difficult, though, to intentionally cultivate a lot of these fungi that we might want to make use of?
Some, no. Like the mushrooms that produce psilocybin are not super complicated to grow. You have to have the kind of the right setup, but if you have the right setup, you can grow them. They're dung fungi, right? So you just have to give them kind of the right kind of food, and you can grow a lot of mushrooms. There are other kinds of compounds that would probably be more usefully manufactured in, you know, in an industrial warehouse kind of setting. You know, there's, for example, paper making relies on, when you make paper out of wood, it relies a lot on certain kinds of enzymes that are actually extracted out of a species of fungus, a trichoderma, and that's an industrial vat. I haven't ever seen that myself, but I've read about it, and that scale of industry will sometimes be necessary depending on how the drug is used, et cetera. So you don't always, I wouldn't anticipate that you'd always have to grow the mushroom, but sometimes it's not so difficult to grow the mushroom.
And in our last minute or so, Anne, it seems like it must be exciting to study fungus because there's a lot we don't know, right?
Yeah, it's my old advisor said it's like a gigantic Easter egg hunt. And every time you turn around, there's another wonderful egg. Well, first of all, the people who study fungi are just fun. Kind of by definition, if you are wacky enough to think that this is how you want to make your career, then you're pretty great. So it's a great community of people, but the questions are really interesting, and there's a lot of them. You're not wanting for things to do.
Anne, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Anne Pringle, professor of botany and bacteriology at UW-Madison and the former president of the Mycological Society of America. She talked to us about fungi, which is one of the stars of the show at this year's Wisconsin Science Festival. She's on a break from sharing information about fungus at said festival. Coming up after the news, we want to hear your best recipe for potatoes, or maybe your biggest potato cooking question. It's a special potato edition of Food Friday. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.